Welcome, and thank you for standing by. At this time, I'd like to inform all participants that you have been placed in a listen-only mode until the question-and-answer session of today's call. At that time, if you would like to ask a question, please press star followed by one. Please make sure your phone is unmuted and record your name clearly when prompted. I would now like to turn the call over to Mr. John Bateman. Thank you, sir. You may begin.
Thank you, Missy. Good morning, and thanks to everyone for joining this monthly climate update call, part of the suite of climate services that NOAA provides to government, business, academia, and the public to support informed decision-making. I'm John Bateman with NOAA Communications, and I'll be facilitating the call today. If you have any additional questions after the conclusion of today's call, my colleague John Leslie and I can be both reached by email at, and I will spell it, nesdis.pa@noaa.gov. And that's nesdis.pa@noaa.gov. Today's update will feature three short presentations, followed by an operator-assisted question and answer session. A copy of the presentation our speakers will follow can be downloaded from the link in the media advisory if you have not done that already. With that, I will introduce our speakers. The first presenter is Karen Gleason, a climatologist with NOAA's National Centers for Environmental Information, who will provide a summary of the July 2022 U.S. and Global Climate Report, as well as the latest drought monitor update. Our second presenter is Megan Chargorodsky, the interim state climatologist for Kentucky, who will provide a review of the catastrophic flooding that devastated parts of eastern Kentucky in late July. And our third presenter is Matt Rosenkranz, a meteorologist at NOAA's Climate Prediction Center, who will provide the latest El Niño-La Niña update, as well as the U.S. temperature, precipitation, and drought outlook for September, October, and November. Our first speaker will be Karen from NOAA NCEI.
Thanks, John, and thank you all for joining our presentation today. Let's turn our attention to slide number two, and we will begin by looking at the global temperatures for July of 2022. We see that the July global surface temperature departure for 2022 was the sixth highest in the 143-year record for July, with global land and ocean departure values at 0.87 degrees Celsius or 1.57 degrees Fahrenheit above the 20th century average. The five warmest Julys on record have all occurred since 2016. Global land departure values were 1.26 degrees Celsius or 2.27 degrees Fahrenheit above average, ranking second warmest on record for July. And the global ocean departure values were 0.72 degrees Celsius or 1.30 degrees Fahrenheit above average, which translates to a ranking of seventh warmest. As you can see from the temperature departure map on the left-hand side of the slide, with red shades denoting warmer than average and blue shades cooler than average temperatures, the month of July was characterized by warmer than average conditions across much of North America, Asia, Europe, in South America. Near to and cooler than average July temperatures were present across parts of Australia, Eastern Europe, Western India, Central Russia, and Eastern and Southern South America. Consistent with La Niña conditions, sea surface temperatures were below average over much of the South Central, Central, and Eastern tropical Pacific Ocean. The map, the percentile map on the right-hand side shows how the departure values that were on the left compare to that 143-year period of record for that specific location. And as you can see from the bright red colors on that map, record high July temperatures were observed in parts of North and South America, as well as Southern and Eastern Asia, Europe, and parts of the Northern and Southern Pacific Ocean. Regionally speaking, we saw North America had its second warmest July on record, Asia was third warmest, South America fourth warmest, and Europe ranked sixth warmest for the month of July. During the month, as many of you may know, an unprecedented heat wave affected much of Europe and many European countries that include Italy, Portugal, Spain, and the United Kingdom, and set new record-high July maximum temperatures across the region. And overall, across the entire globe, the record-warm July temperatures encompassed approximately 7.3% of the world's surface, which is the fourth highest percentage during the month of July. Moving on now to slide number 3, we see the global temperature percentiles for the most recent year-to-date period, which is January through July. And let's see, the January to July global surface temperatures, the departure was 0.86 degrees Celsius or 1.55 degrees Fahrenheit above the long-term average, and that translates to the sixth highest January to July temperature in the 143-year record. The five warmest January to July periods on record have occurred since 2015. Looking at that map, the record warm temperatures were present across portions of Europe, Asia, and parts of the northern and southern Pacific Ocean. Consistent with La Nina patterns, sea surface temperatures were below average over much of the south central, central, and eastern tropical Pacific. Regionally speaking, Asia had a ranking for the seven-month period of second warmest behind the year 2020. And according to the National Center for Environmental Information Statistical Analysis, 2022, by the end of the year, is very likely to rank among the 10 warmest years on record, but only has about a 10.5% chance of ranking among the five warmest years on record. Looking now at slide number 4 and zooming in a little closer to home, we see that the average temperature for the contiguous U.S. was 76.4 degrees Fahrenheit or 2.8 degrees Fahrenheit above the long-term mean. This was the third warmest July in our 128-year record. And in fact, for overnight temperatures, July ranked warmest on record for both July and any month on record, eclipsing the average minimum temperature observed that occurred in July of 2012 by 0.02 of a degree Fahrenheit. Looking at the map on the left, in general, we see across the contiguous U.S. temperatures were above average or record warm across most of the lower 48. Texas had its warmest July on record, with average maximum or typically daytime temperatures exceeding 100 degrees Fahrenheit on average for the first time on record during the month of July. Near record warmth was widespread from the Pacific Northwest to the South Central U.S. and across portions of the Northeast. In addition to Texas ranking warmest on record, Oregon ranked fourth warmest, while Colorado, New Mexico, Oklahoma, Louisiana, Florida, and Rhode Island each had their fifth warmest July on record. For precipitation across the contiguous U.S., the average total was 2.74 inches, which is about 0.04 of an inch below the long-term mean, which translates to a near-average ranking. Looking at the map on the right-hand side of the slide, we see rainfall was above average in pockets across the West Coast, the Southwest, portions of the Northern Rockies and Plains, the Great Lakes, and from the Ohio Valley to the Southern Appalachians. Below average precipitation occurred across portions of the Northwest, the Southern Plains, the Upper Midwest, and parts of the Northeast. Record rainfall during the last week of July contributed to a ranking of fourth wettest for the state of Kentucky, and Megan will speak to this particular flooding event here shortly. A lack of precipitation across the Northeast and the South resulted in Rhode Island ranking second driest and Texas fifth driest for the month of July. Looking at now at slide number 5, we're looking at the map for the contiguous U.S. for the current year-to-date period, January to July, and we see that temperatures averaged 52.7 degrees Fahrenheit or 1.4 degrees Fahrenheit above the long-term mean, which translates to a ranking of above average. Looking at the map on the left-hand side of the slide, we see temperatures were above average from Oregon to the Gulf Coast and from the Gulf Coast up to New England. Both California and Florida ranked sixth warmest for this period, and below average temperatures occurred across portions of the upper Midwest for this 7-month period. Precipitation averaged 16.58 inches, which is about an inch and a half below the long-term mean, and this falls into a ranking that's in the lowest third of the distribution, which means it's below average. We saw California ranked driest on record for this period, while Nevada and Texas ranked second driest, Utah fourth driest. Looking now at slide number six, we turn our attention to the latest U.S. drought monitor map that was released this morning. We see that approximately 49.2% of the contiguous U.S. is currently in drought, which is about 0.2% lower than it was in early July. Looking at the map, we see that drought severity or extent lessened across much of the Southeast, and as well in the Southwest and Central Rockies as a result of many of the monsoonal rains experienced this summer. Drought severity did increase or intensify across portions of the Northeast, as well as the Central and Southern Plains. Outside of the contiguous U.S., we saw that significant rainfall received over the course of the last month helped to eliminate the drought in Alaska, as well as the severity and extent of drought across Puerto Rico. And we saw that for the islands in Hawaii, drought expanded or intensified across many of those islands. And with that, I'll turn the presentation over to Megan, who will talk about the flash flooding event in Kentucky last month.
Thank you, Karen. This is Megan Shargorodsky from the Kentucky State Climate Office. Starting on slide seven, we will take a closer look at Kentucky. July was an exceptional month for Kentucky. Looking at the U.S. drought monitor on this page, we can see that we started off the month with over 50% of the state in moderate drought and ended it with one of the wettest Julys on record. To provide just a bit of context, heading into July, the state was generally at or near normal rainfall for the year to date. However, when breaking that down into the previous 3 months, looking at April to June, there was about a 2 to 3 inch deficit. Combined with the significant heat wave that we experienced in June, this led to the rapid intensification and onset of drought conditions in the state. These drought conditions created very dry soil, which can act as a solid barrier under heavy rainfall and acted as a complication with the severe flooding that we saw. Moving on to slide eight, July ended with significant precipitation. This devastating flooding from July 26th through 29th, 2022, across eastern Kentucky was some of the worst that many in the state have ever seen in their life. At the same time, extreme drought was creeping into the state and far western Kentucky. Statewide, Kentucky experienced the fourth wettest July on record with an average statewide average of 7.93 inches, which is 3.07 inches above normal. Diving down into the climate divisions, the Eastern Climate Division, which is where the extreme flooding happened, had its number one wettest July on record, averaging 11.16 inches across the division, which is 5.91 inches above normal. The Western Climate Division in far western Kentucky, where we were seeing the extreme drought, had its 29th wettest on record with an average rainfall total of 5.22 inches, which is just under an inch above normal. Kentucky Mesonet stations that are located in Breathitt County measured over 17 inches of rainfall during July 2022, with over half of that being recorded during the flooding event, which can be seen on the next slide. So let's look at these observations a little bit closer in slide nine. The radar estimates exceed 6 inches of rainfall over a very large portion of eastern Kentucky. This is confirmed by ground observations from the Kentucky Mesonet. The area of highest rainfall, greater than 10 inches, were unfortunately just south of the Mesonet monitoring stations. So those observations were not measured. They were only taken from radar estimates. However, there was a National Weather Service cooperative station located at Buckhorn Lake in Perry County, and it recorded 8 inches of rain in 24 hours. The existing state record for the 24-hour precipitation max rainfall is 10 0.48 inches. The event total for the station was 11.76 inches. Looking at recurrence intervals, this is considered to be about a 1,000-year flood. Moving on to slide number 10, much of the population in Appalachia lives in the valleys. So unfortunately, the combination of steep valleys, high-intensity rainfall, and the timing resulted in widespread flash flooding of aerial and rivers. So taking into account also the fact that most of this happened overnight in combination with the drought conditions that had been seen already, it was very significant. The Kentucky River is a very major waterway throughout eastern Kentucky, and it has several forks. These forks meet in Lee County, where devastating flooding happened last year in February 2021 when the town of Beattyville was destroyed. It was a similar story, but the flooding was much more localized. In this case, this was a multi-county flooding event. During the July 26th through 29th, 2022 event, the North Fork of the Kentucky River at Whitesburg on the left had the United States Geological Survey stream gauge record over 6 feet higher than the previous record, which was 14.7 feet in 1957 before the gauge failed. At Jackson on the right, the crest also broke previous record of 43.1 feet from the 1939 storm by a few inches. Both of these previous records were the flood of record for the area. Moving on to slide number 11, there were many impacts from the event, but a few notable impacts are listed here on this slide. Washed out roadways caused significant problems in rescue and recovery efforts, as well as people just being able to drive around after the storm. It was very hard for many people to get around. Many areas were without power and clean water. There were boil advisories for water for a while, as well as communications were also affected. During the event itself, phone lines went out in most of the affected areas, and the National Weather Service in Jackson, Kentucky, could not call around to get local reports to help for their warnings. The Kentucky Mesonet stations that were out there were one of the few means of data that they could actually retrieve in real time. Farmers have had a rough growing year in 2022. Many crops stressed from drought are now lost due to the flooding. Whenever crops get covered with mud or are too wet for too long, they create either a mold and are unharvestable. On top of that, also grade schools are having a delayed start to the school year due to damaged buildings and infrastructure, and also because of the utility and transportation impacts. And with that, I am going to hand this back over to Matt Rosenkranz.
Good morning, everybody. slide 12 is where we're going to start talking about the current state of El Nino or the ENSO system, which we are currently in a La Nina advisory. So the left-hand image shows the sea surface temperature anomalies, which still shows that we have below normal sea surface temperatures in the Central Pacific. And those are about somewhere between -1 and -2 degrees in that area. The latest Nino 3.4 value, which is our official single metric for on a week-to-week basis, has a value of -1.1 degrees centigrade. That's pretty close to as low as it got during the winter of 2022 as well. So it's La Nina is still strong and robust, both in the ocean and the atmosphere. The trade winds, the low-level winds across the Pacific were quite strong for most of the second half of July and the first part of August. After in early July, there was some weakening of those trade winds, but they came back and surged and have actually been almost near a record value when you average them across the Pacific. So looking forward, the official CPC ENSO forecast does have the highest odds for La Nina through December, January, February of 2023. And that maintains up to about a 60% chance through that December, January, February season. Then January, February, March, La Nina and Enzo Neutral end up with about even odds during the January, February, March, and then Enzo Neutral is the most likely category for next spring as of right now. Again, those forecasts out that far are subject to change, and we issue them an update every month. Closer, though, I do want to mention that La Nina is expected to continue, the chances of La Nina gradually decreasing from 86% in the coming season down to that about 60% during that December, January, February season. Slide 13 is our monthly outlook, which has the backdrop of that La Nina, as well as the other intra-seasonal modes, things that vary on timescales shorter than a couple of months. One of the major ones we look at is the Madden-Julian Oscillation, which is another variability in the tropics. And that's actually been quite weak during the month of July, centered over the Indian Ocean for its active region, and not really having a big impact on the circulations over the Eastern Pacific and the Atlantic, which have both been kind of, in the same pattern for a while now. We haven't seen much things to kind of shake up and change the pattern. But that is actually forecast to change in the next 2 weeks, with the Madden-Julian Oscillation actually forecast to become a bit more active in the next 2 weeks. So that does actually add some uncertainty to the monthly outlook, which, though there's a bit of a big area of equal chances on the maps here, from about the lower Mississippi Valley to the east to the southeast coast, in a lot of the maps, and a lot of the tools also have that. So out west, and from the northern Rockies down to the Four Corners region southwest, to the Rio Grande Valley, we are expecting above normal temperatures. Those are favored, with the probabilities exceeding 50% right around the Four Corners region, down to the upper parts of the Rio Grande Valley near El Paso. Trends are strongest in that region. They've had a good monsoon coverage, but the monsoon does tend to wind down during September, and we're not expecting that to continue through the later part of September. So anywhere that the monsoon kind of pulls out of early could absolutely return to above normal temperatures, which is the most favored category on the outlook and in many of our tools. The Northeast is also likely to have above normal temperatures with the ongoing dry conditions there. I know they had a bit of rain last night, but there's some very highly entrenched dry conditions in the Northeast. So that's the kind of proximate local cause, and long-term trends during September are also for slightly above normal temperatures in the Northeast. For precipitation for September, we are expecting the monsoon to be robust through about the first half of the month of December, and then it's likely to proceed southward. So our forecast area of above normal precipitation is really restricted to the southern half of Arizona, and only very small portions of New Mexico. The above normal in the southeast U.S. Is related to any potential tropical activity, as well as the fact that we are likely to have a bit of a long-term trough over the eastern U.S., which could push some frontal boundaries down into the southeast, especially later in the month. Moving to slide 14, the seasonal outlook for September, October, and November. The seasonal temperature outlook does indicate a broad swath of above normal temperatures, basically for most of the contiguous U.S., with the exception of the Pacific Northwest and the Northern Plains. The highest odds for above normal temperatures are centered in the Central Rockies, mainly in Utah and Colorado, and those probabilities do exceed 60%. There's a small area of above normal temperatures where they're highly favored in the Northeast as well, where the September and October could start, or September especially, could start out quite warm due to the ongoing drought. And once you have the ongoing drought, you have plant stress. You can have some plants drop leaves early, and then that can actually lead to more solar radiation causing higher temperatures. So there's lots of factors that go into the outlook on why drought can cause high temperatures, especially in areas that are normally highly covered and highly foliated. The trends there are also quite strong, especially for the month of October and November in the Northeast. So the one addition that changed to the map this month from last month's outlook, we did actually add an area of below normal temperatures where below normal temperatures are favored in central Alaska, and that gets down towards the Kenai Peninsula as well. That's kind of showing the influence of the beginning influences of La Nina, which would have more of an impact towards November, and an even stronger impact in the winter. Now that we're kind of getting much closer to some of these, getting through the transition season and our certainty about La Nina is higher, we can start to include more of those impacts in these outlooks. For the seasonal precipitation, seeing some of that footprint of La Nina could bring some above normal precipitation to the Pacific Northwest, mainly Washington and extreme northern Oregon, would also kind of favor some below normal precipitation from the Four Corners region and Central Rockies over to the parts of the Ohio and Tennessee Valley. Also, there is some enhanced odds for below normal temperatures in southern Alaska. Again, where if we have cold to the north of that, the outlook implies a big trough, and you can kind of keep some of the storm track out of that region and steer it a bit further south. So that's why we favor below normal precipitation there. How does that all integrate into the drought outlook, which is slide 15? The seasonal drought outlook does actually call for some improvement across much of the southern tier of the U.S., where some of the monsoon moisture could hang on in the southwest U.S. And then you'll have some of those frontal boundaries that kind of push down and create some precipitation in the southeast. So those frontal boundaries could create some good precipitation across the southern tier of the southern plains. And that can lead to some short-term drought improvement. And then especially as we get into the October-November time periods, some of the plant life will start to, become dormant. And then you can lead to less evapotranspiration and use of the moisture for the plant. So that can lead to any bit of moisture can help have a much bigger impact on recharging your soils from drought conditions during the fall period. So that's why the improvement is likely from the basically Arizona over to Arkansas. West of that, of Arizona, so California, Nevada, Utah, and Oregon, drought is forecast to persist as they're not expected to get significant precipitation in the August to November period. It would be too early for the impacts of kind of the winter storm to get in there. Usually the climatology that usually does not start until later in December and then go through January, February, March. But with La Nina and the outlook going further, we do have forecasts for below normal precipitation is favored through many of those winter months. The drought in the Northeast is also forecast to persist despite the recent rains. As the stream flows there are very low, and it will take a number and rounds of storms and precipitation to fully recharge the soil moisture in the Northeast. There is about a bit of drought development possible across the northern plains, especially given that September, October, November can be quite a dry period across there climatologically. And then if you have any kind of above normal temperatures, which are in some of the, in the outlook for some of that region, you can just kind of have a slowly increasing drought throughout that period. So that is the last slide I have, and I will turn it back to John.
All right. Thanks so much, Matt. We will now take specific questions from the call participants. Please be sure to identify who you would like to answer the question if possible. Misty, could you remind the call participants how they can ask a question, and then please queue up the first question?
Yes, sir. If you would like to ask a question over the phone, please press star followed by one please make sure your phone is unmuted and record your name clearly when prompted. The first question comes from Seth Bornstein. Your line is open, sir.
Yes, thank you so much for doing this. It's two questions. The first one is for Megan, and the second is for anyone who can answer it, probably Karen or Matt. Megan, can you expand a little on how sort of the weather whiplash here, you know, going from drought to, you know, 11 inches of rain in a single event, how the drought and the heat set up the worsening impacts, and how, you know, it's one thing to go through an extreme, but then to go from one extreme to the other, how is that affecting the people and sort of just the environment of that area? I mean, just the, you know, that all or nothing thing. And then for Karen or Matt, this is, Kentucky is not the only place where we were seeing a lot of weather whiplash. Can you tell us how this is connected to climate change, if at all, and where else are we seeing it? I mean, I think of the, if you can address the Death Valley, I mean, going from drought to flood to drought again, you know, how much are we seeing of this whiplash between extremes? Thank you.
All right, thank you for your question. This is Megan Shargorodsky from the Kentucky Climate Office. So we really have had a lot of whiplash, and this even goes back into previous years, even looking at this most recent December when we had the devastating tornadoes that went through the western part of the state. Much of that is still in recovery, and granted, this is in eastern Kentucky where we're seeing this, but the state as a whole is just exhausted. It is really difficult to emotionally go through all of these extremes and, you know, get through it and figure out how to be resilient through the disaster after disaster that we see. And unfortunately, Kentucky is in this crux that is having a lot of these extremes because of how the weather systems are setting up. And some of that's because of La Nina, which Matt may be able to talk a little bit more about. But more specifically with Kentucky, you know, we see these periods of drought. We see these very extreme heat. In fact, as they were doing recovery efforts in eastern Kentucky, they were under an excessive heat warning for a little while because there was just the way the weather system set up, there was a significant heat wave again that following week. And so whiplash is really truly the only way you can describe it. And everyone is just exhausted. And there's only so much that, you know, we can do. We do what we can. And as I mentioned, there are repeated floods that happen in eastern Kentucky. So not only are they having the whiplash from having drought and then rain and then heat and so forth, but they're also having it from previous years where they've experienced flooding in these areas. So it's difficult.
Thank you.
This is Karen Gleason, and I will attempt to address Seth's second question, which I believe, if I can paraphrase, is how are these sort of whiplash events going from dry to wet or just really extreme intense rainfall events, how are those connected to climate change? So it was hinted, and we didn't go into depth with this in this particular presentation, but in addition to the flooding that occurred in Kentucky, a couple days prior to that, and really from the same system, which was a stalled frontal boundary, and, you know, with warm, moist air pushing up from the Gulf, helping to provide fuel or moisture for the event, there was also extreme flash flooding that occurred in the suburbs of St. Louis. And then the following week, after the Kentucky flooding, there also was significant flooding in southern Illinois. So these are all somewhat connected to one another, having, you know, stalled frontal boundaries, having Gulf moisture, fuel storms or fuel showers isn't a new thing. But the one thing that we do anticipate and we are seeing in the data is that with increasing temperatures, the air has an increased capacity to hold more moisture. And so it's almost like taking two identical sponges and just filling one more sponge up with a little bit more water and then wringing them out with the same kind of pressure. The sponge that had more water will precipitate or release more moisture over the same period of time. And so seeing, flash flooding events that exceed 1 in 100 or 1 in 1,000 years isn't going to be unheard of. We probably will see an increased frequency and are already seeing an increased frequency of these events. So there certainly is a connection with, global warming or increasing temperatures, allowing for more moisture to be held by the atmosphere. So, there is a connection, but the setup of the synoptics or the larger scale weather systems, that's not necessarily a new thing.
Thank you.
Thank you. I'm showing no other questions at this time. Again, if you would like to ask a question, that is star followed by one. Again, that is star followed by one. Thank you. The next question again comes from Seth Bornstein. Your line is open.
If no one else is going to ask any other questions, Karen, going to slide 3 and what you guys usually call the horse race, year-to-date global temperature, it looks like you're around 5th or 6th. Is this would this be the warmest La Nina year, or are some of those other 5 La Nina years?
This is Karen Gleason. That's a really good question. I haven't actually looked at those top contenders and compared them to El Nino and La Nina years. Let me, when we're done with the call, let me do a comparison and see where it falls out. But I do know that in general, just kind of broad brush stroke, we do know that during La Nina years, the global temperature tends to be suppressed somewhat from the sort of the current neighborhood, and during El Nino years, it tends to be a little bit warmer. But what we have seen the last couple of years is that even though the La Nina global temperatures are a little bit lower, they're really not dropping as much as maybe we've seen in prior years. And I believe we have a graphic also on our global website that addresses and kind of color codes the years based on their categorization between El Nino, La Nina, and a neutral year. But it's still those La Nina years, the last couple of years especially, are still kind of up there. They haven't dropped significantly. So, we're definitely in what we call sort of like a new neighborhood, but that variation between El Nino and La Nina either boost the temperature in an El Nino year or bring it back during a La Nina. It's quite possible, and I won't know until I look more closely at the data, that this may be one of the warmest La Nina years that we have. But I will follow up with you after the call to see if that is indeed the case.
Great. You have my email. Thank you.
Showing no other questions at this time.
All right. Thanks so much, Missy. If there are no further questions, I will wrap up the call. First, I'd like to thank all of our speakers for their time and to everyone else for participating in the conference call. And I will end by reminding you to mark your calendar for a couple of upcoming events. The release of the August and Summer 2022 U.S. Climate Report is scheduled for September 9th. The release of the August 2022 Global Climate Report is scheduled for September 14th. And the next monthly media climate call is scheduled for September 15th at 11 a.m. Eastern Time. Lastly, an audio file of this call will be posted on the NOAA.gov media advisory site later today. And if you have any further informational needs, please feel free to email me, John Bateman. My contact information is available at the top of the media advisory. Thank you.
Thank you for participating in today's conference. You may disconnect at this time, and thank you for joining.